Today is Tuesday, January 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, Iran's parliament has passed an urgent bill declaring the U.S. military's command at the Pentagon in Washington and those acting on its behalf are terrorists, subject to Iranian sanctions.
آمران و عاملان این جنایت که از پنتاگون و نیروهای نظامی اونها هستند جز تروریست ها محسوب میشه.
Plus, will troops stay or leave Iraq? We'll have the latest from the Pentagon. Those stories and more are all coming up next on today's International Edition. A warning from the U.S. Maritime Administration to ships crossing Mideast waterways. AP's Mike Hempen starts us off.
The warning says there is the possibility of Iranian action against U.S. maritime interests in the Mideast. It has been issued to ships crucial to global energy supplies and cites rising threats after an American drone strike in Baghdad killed a top Iranian general. Oil tankers were targeted in mine attacks last year that the U.S. blamed on Iran. Tehran denied being responsible, but it did seize oil tankers around the crucial Strait of Hormuz. I'm Mike Hempen.
Iran's Fars News Agency cites an emergency services official saying that a stampede among mourners during the funeral ceremony for Commander Qasem Soleimani has reached at least 40 and 213 others were wounded. In addition, Iran's parliament has passed an urgent bill declaring the U.S. military's command at the Pentagon and those acting on its behalf are terrorists subject to Iranian sanctions. The measure appears to mirror a decision by U.S. President Donald Trump in April to declare Iran's Revolutionary Guard a terrorist organization. The U.S. Defense Department used the Guard's designation to support the strike that killed top General Qasem Soleimani, who was viewed by Iranians as a national hero for his work leading the Guard's expeditionary Quds forces. This comes as the semi-official Fars News Agency reports Iran has been considering 13 revenge scenarios as a retaliatory measure, and after a U.S. official speaking to Reuters News said the United States denied a visa to Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif that would have allowed him to attend a United Nations Security Council meeting in New York on Thursday. Speaking to reporters today, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said that any action the United States takes against Iran would be within the guidelines set by international law. That question came after President Trump indicated that he may target Iranian cultural sites, which would be a war crime.
Let me tell you who's done damage to the Persian culture. It's not the United States of America. It's the Ayatollah. If you want to look at who has denied religious freedom, if you want to know who has denied the Persian culture is rich and steeped in history and intellect, and they've denied the capacity for that culture to continue. If you go back and look at the holidays around Cyrus and Nowruz, they've not permitted people to celebrate. They've not allowed people that they've killed, that Qasem Soleimani killed, they've not allowed them to go mourn their family members. The real risk to Persian culture does not come from the United States of America. There is no mistake about that.
Joining us now to discuss the further implications of rising tensions in the region is Eric Brewer. He is the Deputy Director and Fellow for the Project on Nuclear Issues and International Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Eric, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
As we see developments continue between Tehran and Washington, I wanted to get your take on what you believe is the most important thing to look at as these events continue to unfold.
Well, I think a couple of things, right? I think for one, although things are escalating, we're not at World War III yet, and we're not likely to be. Right now, because of the strike against Soleimani, there's pressure on Iran to retaliate, and the government has said that it's going to do so, but I think we can expect Iran also to retaliate on its own timescale. It's going to take its time. It's going to want to respond in a way that hits back, but also in a way that's proportional, that doesn't push the U.S. too far to even escalate further. And so there's, the U.S. strike certainly doused some gasoline on the fire in the Middle East, and right now things are pretty tense. But Iran's certainly trying to balance competing objectives because it knows it's going to lose in any major conventional war with the United States. But again, it does have to respond.
Speaking of responding, and you mentioned it would most certainly possibly lose in a conventional war type situation with the United States. There's been some concern about interactions in maritime waters as well as cyber strikes. Do you foresee Tehran possibly responding in those types of arenas rather than directly confronting the United States?
I think it's hard to predict exactly what Iran's response will be. It certainly has capabilities across all those areas. It has quite a significant reach in the Middle East and the ability to target U.S. forces and facilities over there. It also has a range of asymmetric responses, including cyber, including attacks on shipping, which we've seen over the course of this past six or seven months. So it certainly has the ability to respond there. And so I think all of those are certainly possible. It's probably going to want to probably choose a mix of responses, right? It's going to need, because of the public posture that it's taken, it's going to need to respond in a way that is subtly attributable to Iran. But it can also mix its responses up and respond in other ways that hide Iran's hand a lot more.
Turning to the discussion on nuclear development in Iran, where do you see things going from here now that Tehran has said it's pulling back from the 2015 accord, even though some world powers are still trying to salvage the deal?
So I think that Iran, one thing to clarify, Iran actually is not leaving the deal and it's not abandoning all of its commitments. This was reported initially out there, and that's a little bit incorrect. What Iran actually announced is that it's no longer going to abide by one of the restrictions in the deal that limits the number of centrifuges that Iran can have and use at its nuclear facilities. And so that move sort of builds on a lot of steps that Iran has taken since May of 2019 to slowly roll back its commitments. You may remember Iran talked about every 60 days it was going to make a new announcement. And so Iran has mostly announced that it's not abiding by some of the major restrictions that limit its enrichment program, a key aspect of what could shorten its timeline to a nuclear device, right? So Iran's made these announcements. They're quite provocative, and quite frankly, they're intended to be provocative and headline-grabbing. But actually, Iran has been quite slow to implement any changes. For example, it abandoned one of the restrictions on the level of enrichment that it can go to. It was 3.67% on the deal. It's only gone to just under 5%, right? So that's a very gradual increase, and it's nowhere near the 90% level that you would need for nuclear weapons. So it is sort of certainly swung the door open to make nuclear progress and to more quickly shorten its breakout timeline to a nuclear weapon, but it is very tentatively and cautiously walking through that door.
Eric Brewer is the deputy director and fellow for the Project on Nuclear Issues and International Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Eric, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Periodically, you may hear some bumps in the road today as we're having some technical problems here in the studio. We do appreciate you understanding as we bring you today's news. Iraq's parliament urged the government to expel 5,200 American troops from the country. The move was to protest the U.S. drone strike that killed General Soleimani in the Baghdad airport. The Shiite majority in the parliament voted for the resolution, calling on the caretaker government to end the bilateral agreement with the U.S.-led coalition to station troops on Iraqi soil. Caretaker Prime Minister Abdel Abdul Mehdi earlier urged Parliament to take urgent measures and end the presence of foreign troops as soon as possible. But he said any decision on U.S. troops must make sure that Iraq's national interests and security are not damaged. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi discussed the different aspects of U.S. presence in Iraq with former Iraqi defense attaché Ismail Azoldani.
Actually, the resolution is an episode of the current tit-for-tat escalation between Iran and the United States. So initially, Kurds and some Sunni blocs had boycotted the session. This resolution, from my perspective, has been adopted based on the emotional motivation to counter the U.S. forces' action, as well as it was pushed by Iranians as a reaction or retaliation for what has happened on a Friday. And it is not well calculated, taking into consideration the enormous challenges and consequences that Iraq will confront economically, politically, and in the security aspect.
Iraqi Parliament Speaker Mohammed Al-Halbousi noted that the agreement cannot be terminated without a one-year grace period. Why then the Parliament would take such a vote?
Well, the resolution technically is non-binding. and will be dedicated to the next government authority to implement it. In fact, there are a number of arguments over the legal framework in which the United States forces have been presented in Iraq. But if that is the case, the Iraqi government should use diplomatic channels and negotiate with the U.S. forces to schedule the timeline to leave. So the one-year grace period must be designated for both parties, so they would be starting counting from that point.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo expressed doubt that the U.S. forces would be expelled, telling Fox News, "We are confident the Iraqi people will want the United States to remain." Do you agree with his assessment?
Well, I partially agree with that assessment, but Iraqi people would welcome the United States forces if that did not make Iraq a battlefield for any conflict between the United States and Iran. Iraq is a fragile state and is not capable to be involved in such a conflict, and that would be harming Iraqi people's interests. Iraqis are against any foreign influence, whether Iranian or from the United States. That's what the situation is. So the U.S. forces are crucial and fundamentally important to exist in Iraq, and Iraqis do not want to be manipulated to be part of any conflict.
But could the U.S. pull out create a security vacuum in Iraq?
No one can deny the instrumental contribution of the U.S. forces in defeating ISIS. They were crucial in providing Air Force support, logistic training, intelligence, and advisory support. And although ISIS has lost its local support and significant capabilities in Iraq, they will still pose a threat in different areas in North and West Iraq. At the same time, Iraqi forces are missing many fundamental factors to rely on themselves. So I think that this is going to be challenging, and any pullout, Iraqis will be concerned about the 2014 scenario would be repeated. So that's why I'm saying that there are huge challenges and consequences due to that pullout from Iraq, and Iraqis should take into consideration what will happen and how Iraqis will be containing these kind of threats.
President Trump said U.S. troops will not leave Iraq until Iraq pays for the airbase in Iraq.
You know, not only that, Iraqi assets and funds and money and budget are still protected by the U.S. administration, and there is a presidential executive orders issued every year to renew that protection. And Iraqi government, parliament, Iraqi politicians should take into consideration that would be harming the Iraq interest. If Iraq would be under the sanctions, that would be disastrous consequences on Iraq economy, especially and in particular.
And that was former Iraqi defense attaché Ismail Aslodani speaking to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb recently asked General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, about the withdrawal.
Bottom line, nobody is leaving Iraq at this time.
Right. That letter is a draft. It was a mistake. It was unsigned. It should not have been released. Poorly worded implies withdrawal. That is not what's happening.
And joining us now live from the Pentagon is VOA correspondent Carla Babb. Thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here.
So can you explain more about the confusion over what has been reported in multiple media outlets about whether or not U.S. troops are, in fact, leaving Iraq?
Okay, so the confusion started yesterday when this letter began circulating on social media. It was an unsigned letter from General Seeley, one of the commanders in Iraq, and it was basically saying that the United States was going to be doing some onward movement. That was the terminology that was used in the letter, and it sounded like the U.S. was getting out of Iraq. What was actually happening is that the United States forces are moving around a lot more because they're changing their posture so they can be more defensive and to protect their own troops. And so the helicopter movement in Baghdad and Taji, which is just a few kilometers away, and then in and out of Kuwait and Iraq. So with all that happening, they wanted to properly inform their Iraqi counterparts. They were sending in a letter to some of their Iraqi counterparts to look at the language and help with the language, and somehow that letter was leaked. And the letter was a draft. I've been told directly, as you heard from General Milley, it was a draft. It was unsigned. It should have never been leaked. It should have never gotten out. And the bottom line is the United States is not leaving Iraq at this time. They are protecting their forces in Iraq at this time, especially with the threat of Iranian-backed forces.
Now, speaking of the threat of Iranian forces, has there been any discussions about either changing troop deployment in the region or adding additional troops to combat any perceived threats?
Well, things begin changing every morning that I walk into the Pentagon, it feels like. Where we are now is we've added additional 14,000 troops from May to late December to the Middle East region. After the attack on the embassy, we added an additional 4,000 troops from North Carolina. A brigade went into Kuwait. I have heard this morning, I have been able to confirm that there are some B-52 bombers that are in the area, just on standby, and there may be some further deployments in the coming days. None of them have been announced at this time.
Carla, is there anything else you can share with us about what's going on at the Pentagon regarding the tension in the Middle East?
Well, one thing that officials here have stressed, while they have not provided any evidence or any intelligence on this attack and why they took out Soleimani, they have pointed to the evidence that they said, well, they tell us that the evidence that they had would have made them culpable and negligent to the American people had they not taken out Soleimani. They point to the fact that he has killed hundreds of Americans since he has been the commander of the Quds Force. That's the elite force of the Iranian Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps that does the external operations in countries across the region. And they want to stress that they felt that it was a necessary move. A lot of Democrats, as you have heard, Chuck Schumer in the Senate has said, there's no plan here, and we need to know a plan. But I think this will be hashed out in the coming days. I know that General Milley and Secretary Esper have been trying to brief people on the Hill to make sure that they are aware of what's going on. And at the same time, this building is going to be planning for dozens of scenarios in the coming days.
Carla Babb is VOA's Pentagon correspondent. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
And you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA called on Dr. Stephen Mall, a medical expert from the University of North Carolina, to help treat an astronaut aboard the International Space Station. The astronaut had developed a deep vein thrombosis, or blood clot, in his jugular vein. The biggest concern of this condition is that part of the clot could break off and travel to the lungs, where it could cause a pulmonary embolism. Since it wasn't possible to send Dr. Mall to the ISS to treat the person, he began his evaluation and treatment procedure from his office at UNC. Dr. Mall and NASA doctors decided the best way to treat their patient was with a regimen of blood-thinning drugs. While the supply of these drugs aboard the ISS was limited, it was enough to treat the astronaut until a supply ship delivered medications recommended by Dr. Mall that would successfully complete the treatment. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. We appreciate you understanding if you hear a few audio glitches today, as we are having some technical difficulties. Bring you today's news. Venezuela's opposition leader Juan Guaido took his place in the parliament speaker's seat after a standoff with the armed forces who initially prevented him from entering Congress. Juan Guaido was barred from entering the building by the National Guard for around a half an hour. His rival claimant to the speaker position, Luis Parra, occupied the chair. By the time Guaido was allowed in, alongside allied deputies, Parra had left. Both men claimed on Sunday they had support of enough deputies to be elected president of the legislature. Parra's support mainly comes from deputies loyal to President Nicolas Maduro, while the opposition holds 112 of the 167 seats in the assembly. Guaido said 100 deputies voted for him. Parra claimed the support of only 81 lawmakers. The National Assembly is the only branch of the government in opposition hands. A 6.4 magnitude earthquake has struck Puerto Rico, the largest in a series of quakes that have struck the U.S. territory in recent days. The AP's Zaria Shackley has more.
teams are already out assessing the situation. The mayor of Guyana, Nelson Torres Jordan, said emergency services were looking for anyone injured in the quake. Puerto Rico's power authority said on Twitter that one of the country's main power plants, which sits near the epicenter, had been damaged, but officials expect to restore power to the island later Tuesday. The U.S. Geological Service said the quake hit at 4:24 a.m. just south of the island at a shallow depth of 6.2 miles. It said the quake was followed by a string of aftershocks from 5.6 to 4.5 in magnitude. I'm Zaria Shakili.
Fires have burnt through more than 8.6 million hectares of land across Australia, killing at least 25 people and destroying or damaging thousands of homes, mostly in the southeastern region. Dead birds and burned leaves lay scattered across sands of the once picturesque fishing village of Eden on Australia's southeast coast. The town is known for having one of the best whale-watching spots in the coast. However, these days, the cruise boats in the harbor and boats there are barely visible due to thick smoke and settled in the area. Businesses usually booming at this time of year as tourists flock to the beaches during the summer season, giving local businesses the income they need to survive in the quieter winter season, are no longer there. Local resident Rachel Clark shares that she's never been more afraid in her life.
I've had such high anxiety levels that I've barely been able to get out of my own house. We had to evacuate at 4 o'clock in the morning on Sunday from a property that was over the road from us that was cleared farmland. And it was a 4 kilometre drive down to the Toowoomba Hall. And I've never been so scared in my life. I couldn't see, the smoke was so thick. There was a roar of fire.
All the residents of Eden can do now is wait for the visitors to return. Paris will commemorate the fifth anniversary on Tuesday of the attack on the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo, known for publishing satirical cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. In that attack, 12 people were killed by Islamist gunmen. The killing spree shocked the world and prompted a series of gatherings in support of the newspaper and its staff, culminating in the march through the streets of Paris attended by several world leaders. On the eve of the anniversary of the attack, Charlie Hebdo's lawyer, Richard Malka, said the journalists were still receiving threats but were not giving up their work. 5 years after the attack, Reporters Without Borders is calling on international institutions to protect journalists against religious intolerance, denouncing its rise. The sentiment was echoed by Ahmed Shaheed, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Religion or Belief.
What's happened to freedom of expression in the past 5 years? We see more and more authors prepared to step back from offensive speech. People are self-censoring themselves. People are in fact even regarding that, you know, there should be a stepping back from speech that is offensive to religious establishment. So that means that those who attacked Charlie Hebdo have won because that's what they wanted to do. People to self-censor or not criticize religion or to step back from speech that is robust. So if we keep on regarding ourselves as unable to express ourselves, then fear has won.
Reporters Without Borders called the depenalization of blasphemy, adding that blasphemy is still sanctioned by the death penalty in 6 countries in the world. Tokyo prosecutors obtained an arrest warrant Tuesday for former Nissan chairman Carlos Ghosn's wife on suspicion of perjury, adding to the couple's legal troubles in the country where he once was revered as a star executive. The move against Carol Ghosn, who is not in Japan, followed her husband's flight to Lebanon last week while he was out on bail awaiting trial for alleged financial misconduct. And that's going to do it for today. We thank you for joining us, as well as understanding that we've had some technical difficulties. You've been listening to the International Edition of On the Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and engineer, Nashwan Kale, thank you very much for joining us. You can visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can also find archived episodes of our show on the program page under the Live Radio tab. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.